Welcome to The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
Hey, Nate. Happy, is it International Jazz Day?
We are, we're just around the corner from the actual observance of IJD. It's April 30th every year. Of course, it is the culmination of Jazz Appreciation Month, which is the entirety of April. Here in Philadelphia, we've also been celebrating Philly Jazz Month. So, you know, it's just a whole season of celebration. But this episode aligns nicely with International Jazz Day because we had an international jazz artist here at the station. And not only that, but someone that you are quite friendly with and have hung out with on multiple continents, the great drummer Creston Osgood.
Yeah, the first opportunity I had to meet Creston was when WRTI worked on an English version of a very successful Danish podcast called Farliger Toner, which is Dangerous Sounds here for the English speakers. And if you've never had an opportunity to hear that podcast, we put it together in 2023, and it's pretty awesome, I have to say.
Really, really deeply researched, insightful, sound rich, really beautifully sound designed. Yeah, I mean, I definitely learned some things from this sort of history of jazz as not only an expatriate export, but also something homegrown on Danish soil. Just a lot of different cultural dimensions to this podcast. And I have to say, I was not yet a member of the team at WRTI when I attended the launch party for this podcast. And it featured you two in conversation, just like the one we're about to hear. And it also featured an incredible performance with Creston on drums and Odin Pope on tenor saxophone and Emmanuel Wilkins on alto saxophone. And it was just straight fire. And that performance at the Ruba Club actually was captured for WRTI. You can see it on our YouTube channel, which is WRTI Music. And I highly recommend it. I was there in the room and will not soon forget it.
I tell you one thing also is during the Copenhagen Jazz Festival, which I've been to once, you know, good luck trying to find Creston because he has typically 4 to 5 shows a day.
Right.
I mean, he's somebody who really plays a lot. The reason why we had this conversation here in Philadelphia this time was he was in town to play with Dave Burrell and Marshall Allen and pretty significant stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've always gotten that energy from him, that he's somebody who bridges scenes and generations and styles. And he's also like irrepressible. Like you can't stop this guy from making a session. Like he will find a way to show up and, you know, jump on anybody's bandstand and do his thing. Which I really love.
I also couldn't stop him from hitting my bourbon stash at home.
Well, that is you know,
another topic for another time.
Another topic for another time. But we appreciate anyone with a good bourbon palate as well.
Well, I thought maybe we'd just hang out and listen to this conversation. It's always great to talk to Creston just about any topic whatsoever. He's just pretty well versed in a lot of different things, and in particular, great music.
And I understand that along with the interview, there was a drum kit set up in our studio. Did he do a little something there?
He did partake. Go to WRTI Music on YouTube, where you will see a video of it.
All right, let's get swinging.
Creston Osgood, thank you for joining us here on The Late Set. I appreciate having you here in Philadelphia.
It's amazing to be here.
It's nice because I've sort of been in your domain in Copenhagen, which is where you reside. You are really one of the central musicians in the scene, I believe, in Copenhagen in a lot of ways, connecting to so many different elements of music there and in Europe, as well as being a broadcaster. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about Dangerous Sounds, since that's how you and I sort of came together.
Yeah, that's how we met, yeah.
This is a podcast that was produced by Jazz Denmark and Mono Mono, the production company, and you were the host of that. Mm-hmm. So I guess we're two broadcasters talking right now.
Great. Yeah. So Dangerous Sounds came out in America. We did 8 episodes here. But in Denmark, we did 17 episodes. So we boiled it down. Basically, it's a chronological, semi-chronological story about how jazz came to Denmark and how it evolved over a course of around 100 years. First saxophone arrived in 1923 on an American ship. And the story is just so interesting because, you know, in 1923, Denmark was a pretty isolated country, actually. They had heard a few recordings, but they didn't know which instruments made the sounds. That the local musicians thought that saxophones were Chinese violins. I mean, that tells you something about how little they knew, you know, about what's going on. Almost no black people there, you know. And then they get the saxophone and they kind of just start from scratch and figure it out. And already 2 years later, the first Danish jazz record is made, which was, you know, and that sounds totally out, that record. And then it's the story about how it evolves. Of course, there have been some major events in Danish jazz history that we spent extra time on, like the Louis Armstrong visit in 1933.
To Tivoli.
Yeah, that was a big one, and also the role of Danish jazz during the Second World War, where it became resistance music, and there were some important voices there, like Sven Asmussen, the violin player, and Leo Mathisen, the piano player. John Chikai was, you know, Danish, and was also an important part of the evolution of the music, and so on, all the way up until present time. So that was an amazing. I think I spent like 3 years working on that. There was a team of researchers, but I kind of said what I thought we should dig into. So it's very much also like my idea about what's important and what's not important. Some things were left out, other things were maybe focused more on because I thought it was interesting. And actually now, you don't know this, but we are working on a new continuation of that. It's not called Dangerous Sounds. It's called, I guess it translated into Dangerous Birds, but it sounds better in Danish. Farlige fugle in Danish, which will be a little more, it's more interview based with witness accounts, people who are still around, and also maybe a little more with a perspective about like what's the role of jazz music today and where is it going. And
what's your take on sort of the music scene in Copenhagen today? And where is the music going? Because you have had a lot of major events in how the music has progressed in some ways. Mm. I don't know if progressed is the right word necessarily, but just evolved into different modes of expression.
Yeah.
Now it's kind of all in, anything.
Yeah. I mean, I always get a little, I think it can be dangerous to see, and I kind of did that in my podcast, which I maybe shouldn't have done, but this thing of seeing it as a progression is a problem because all things exist at the same time.
Right.
And Louis Armstrong is still relevant and so on and so on. So it's more like, today we are in an interesting place where there isn't one clear aesthetic or direction. It's kind of a little scattered. And personally, I have also maybe removed myself in the last couple of years a little from being like in the center of my own scene to branching out to more, a more global perspective. I think many of the people I'm playing with are not from Denmark. It seems to me that there is one strain, which is like kind of neo-romantic, I would call it, people who want things to sound pleasant because it's a dangerous world out there and we need the music to comfort us. And it's our safe place where we can go, where things make sense. My generation was all about, when we came up, we were all about confusing people as much as possible and creating, creating havoc and challenging performance forms and so on. Now it's more about looking sharp and playing something that makes sense. GRP is coming back, Larry Carlton. That kind of what you would in America maybe call smooth jazz.
Yeah.
It's quite popular with young people as an expression of youth, which I am embracing, but I don't really understand that. Then there's the avant-garde scene, which has become very cerebral in the last couple of years. Very much about academia. And my good friend Goody Pell, the artist, says academia is the perspective of the drone, which is so perfectly put. I mean, I really think that's so spot on, because you don't get your hands dirty. And you can see it up here and look down, and all the changes that are made don't have any consequences. They stay in the bubble of academia, and that's... I think affects some of the improvising that's going on right now. And it's also this kind of pan-European consensus-oriented free improvisation where they improvise in a way where it's supposed to sound like they, again, that they know what they're doing, and that even though it's art, it still makes sense. This whole thing, it seems to be a tendency right now. I guess because the world is evolving the way it is.
You did perform in Greenland with Snow Leopard.
I did, and I'm going back. I'm going to East Greenland now, which is the most remote place you can go.
East Greenland.
East Greenland.
Is it warmer or colder there?
So, thank you for asking. So, almost everybody in Greenland live on the west coast.
Yeah.
But on the east side, there are two villages, Tasiilaq and Kulusuk. Kulusuk has 250 people. And you fly to Kulusuk. There's two planes a week there. And then you take a helicopter from Kulusuk to Tasiilaq, which is slightly bigger. It has 500 and maybe 470 people.
Yeah.
And that is literally it. Then you have to travel 1,000 kilometers across the ice to get to any other settlement in Greenland, or you have to go over the Atlantic Ocean to get to Iceland. Or so it's so remote, it's ridiculous. And
is it remote and isolated is the question.
It's isolated in such a way that ships can only go there certain months of the year, and you can fly there, and there's only these two flights a week, and it's only if the weather allows. So it is really isolated.
Yeah.
And it's been a lifelong dream for me to go there, because it's heavy, heavy place. But before that, I went to the other side of Greenland, where it's, you can go, you can fly there.
Like the west side.
The west side. And it's such a rich and amazing deep culture there. I played with one of the leading drum dancers, Pauline Lumholt, who recorded all the original drum dancers and cataloged them and wrote down and documented all these, people who are keeping this tradition alive, and was teaching the younger generations of the Inuit people these songs and keeping it alive. So she was like a legend there. So when you walked around with her in Greenland, everybody knew who she was. And being there with her was extremely deep. And she played two different drums. The normal one, which is like a frame drum that you hit with a stick and you do these moves. But then there was the one from the Thule area, which is made from the bladder of a polar bear. And when I hit that, it sounded like I was hitting a plastic bag. Like there was nothing going on. It was no resonance, no life, nothing. When she played it with the right moves and the right words, it created this kind of deep sounding drone that I cannot explain how that could happen. But there was some extra levels going on with that. I mean, spiritual or whatever you want to call it. It's a heavy, heavy music tradition.
This is one of the things I've always appreciated about you, Creston, is that you are about finding life experiences that discover important cultural music and expression. And we bonded, I think, when we went down to Knoxville, Tennessee for Big Ears. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you were saying so many names of musicians that I have spent a lot of time investigating myself. And so I just found sort of companionship there.
Big time, yeah. We are an equal level of nerd.
I think so.
On, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Proudly so.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But just the investigation of sounds, you know, talk to me about how you bring that into your work.
Well, I'm a student of Ed Thigpen. Yeah. I studied very deeply with him for over 10 years. I was very close with him. I also was one of the, what do you call it, pallbearers when you bury someone.
Yes.
We put him in the ground next to Thad Jones. That was his big dream or request or whatever. And being close to him, watching him play, there was some deep knowledge about how to extract sound from the instrument that kind of, to me, became the essence of jazz drumming, as opposed to many other styles of drumming. This, like, focus on sound, on making the sound come out of the instrument. And that has kind of been what my playing has been about ever since. And it's mysterious, but it also has to do with experiences, like life experiences that make you touch the thing in such a way where it resonates more. Like you can almost like pull the resonance out of any object. And to me, that's a very deep life project to have going on with pretty much anything that I'm touching. Like I'm so aware of what I can do with my hands and how I can extract sound. And to me, that's a message that goes beyond any style of music. And that's what's kind of like guiding my, that's my deeper musical search that I'm looking for that.
You were telling me a bit of a story about Aerto.
Yeah.
And how he effectively did the same thing.
Totally. Yeah, I'll tell you that for your listeners. So I was on a beach with Aerto Morea and Flora Purim. This is maybe, I don't know, 18 years ago. We're sitting on the beach, this kind of hang, it's in Denmark, and there's an amazing guy, his name is Ole Strenberg, who's a great jazz drummer actually, but he also plays the accordion and plays, he knows all these sailor songs. So he's entertaining on the accordion and we're hanging out on the beach, and then Aieto picks up these two rocks from the beach and starts jamming along with the accordion. And he made that sound like it was a full-blown samba rhythm section. There was bass drum in there, there was guikas, there was all kinds of uncanny sounds coming from those two rocks that he just would rub against each other and hit against each other in different ways and move around and move his hands around. And I just couldn't believe it. And I just kind of just went out, blurted out, like, how the hell can you do that? And then he just looked at me like and smiled and he said, it's not my first time playing the rocks. You know, that's just so deep. I mean, this is kind of what I'm talking about. Like, and I think there's this like ancient drum wisdom there. Like the drums is a very old thing, goes way, you know, it goes way, way back.
Your body.
Yes. And that's what you hear when you hear these Greenlandic frame drummers. And that's what you hear when you start to view the instrument as an ancient thing, more than actually, like, it's not that's sometimes a misconception in drums. And I think it essentially has to do with capitalism because it's about selling a product to people. But this thing of like commanding the instrument, like wielding it, making it do what you want it to do.
Owning it.
Yeah, this kind of control.
Yeah.
As opposed to approaching it as a magical artifact that can do wondrous things if you allow it to breathe and resonate on a deeper level, you know.
Let's talk more about your investigations into American music as it relates to the quintet that you've had now for more than a dozen years.
Yeah, almost 15 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful group. You can say all their names because I will get all the letters wrong.
Do you want me to say their names?
Please.
On trumpet, it's Erik Kimestad. On saxophone, as we call it in Denmark, saxophone, it's Mads Egetoft. We also call him Oakenshield.
Oakenshield.
And then it's Jeppe Seeberg on the piano.
Yeah.
Piano, as they say in New Orleans. And then it's the Matthias Fleming Petri on the bass. And these guys are around 10 years younger than me. They all went to the Rhythmic Music Conservatory, but they were not my students, although I was a teacher there. And we have that thing in common that we all are deeply interested in jazz music and, you know, in all its forms. Jeppe, the piano player, is really deep into stride piano, really studied, you know, James P. Johnson and that tradition and can really do it. But he's also a huge Jackie Byatt fan, and he's also Fluxus and complete.
He can play Haydn.
He can do anything, yeah.
Yeah.
And the trumpet player, Erik Kimestad, is, you know, has all the, you know, virtues of someone who went deep into why Kenny Dorham is the greatest trumpet player that ever lived. And at the same time, studied Bill Dixon's playing and Rafi Malik and so on and so on. So there's the whole spectrum there.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about playing jazz music too. I wanted to have a band where you can still keep some of those virtues relate to that, such as playing a great solo over some chords, phrasing. I think jazz music is much more about phrasing than people sometimes acknowledge. And swinging, you know, swinging and not being afraid of swinging. Why should we not swing in 2026? Like, why should that be old school to do that?
It ain't illegal, yeah.
Yeah, so do those things that we have studied our whole lives and that we are good at, and at the same time make a contemporary statement without any kind of, you know, postmodernism or irony. Yeah. I feel like we're past that now. That was the 90s, maybe the zeros.
The aughts.
Yeah, but no ironic distance at all to the tradition. Like, fully embracing the tradition, but using it as a fuel to make a contemporary statement. That's what I wanted to do with that band.
Well, I think there's two recordings, is that correct?
Yes, there are two records out, and actually now there's one record coming out only in Latvia.
Okay.
And another one only coming out in Poland.
Great.
And soon I will then release another one globally.
Well, thank you.
There's a lot of stuff coming out now with this band.
Well, let me know so I can plan my itinerary to Europe.
I shall let you know when to go to Latvia to get a copy of.
I really do love the performance that you did with the recording. It was a number of 44 or so, or 40 plus pieces of music that you captured live at H15.
Mm-hmm.
And after having a residency there, you took all this music and you released this recording, and it featured some kind of surprising standards, if you will.
Right.
From, you know, Elmo Hope and Clifford Jordan.
Right, yeah.
And also a beautiful piece of music for Leo Mathisen.
Exactly, yeah. Long Shadows.
Yeah.
One of his greatest pieces, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, tell me a little bit about that, because it appears in Dangerous Sounds as well.
Yeah, about Leo Mathisen.
Yeah.
I mean, he's probably the first, like, truly original-sounding musician where you can say he's a jazz musician, but it's also somehow Danish-sounding.
Yeah. He had a vibe.
He had a vibe, yeah. And he did these like lyrics in English, but like with a heavy Danish accent and like making up his own words. And
yeah,
he was very
connected to Fats Waller in some ways.
Totally, yeah. He was a very, very free spirit. And he had a kind of a steady gig at this place called, I think it was called the Restaurant München in Copenhagen during the Second World War, where he played every night with his band. And it was just totally rowdy. Like he was just improvising, and the band were improvising their parts. Like, you know, nothing was written down, arrangements. It was just like really energetic and free. And his own playing was also kind of, I'm hearing a little bit of like Ellingtonian things in his playing. It's very creative and original. But this kind of approach to the piano, where it's just more seen as a sea of possibilities. I don't know. I don't want to get into trying to describe what Ellington's piano playing is like. That's probably a bad idea. But I'm hearing something there, some kind of Ellingtonian influence. And yeah, and then he was a great composer and just a huge personality. He always had a big cigar in his mouth and was sweating, and it was, you know.
Yeah.
But he was also like a supernova. Like he burned out very quickly. He got a kind of brain
aneurysm.
Yeah, maybe that's the word. Like some kind of infection in his brain, or something that made his brain rot, kind of. And he spent the last 20 or something like that years in a retirement home and didn't play.
Yeah.
So it was a brief period, but very intense period that he was there, as opposed to Sven Asmussen, who was his contemporary, who had a really well-dressed band, who played the arrangements right, swinging their asses off, and Sven lived to be almost 100 years old, or maybe even 100 years old. He got very old and was playing up until at least 90, I think.
Yeah. This live recording at age 15... it's wonderful in a lot of senses, but, you know, I actually got to sort of imagine the experience of the recording, because the following year you had, I think it was 3 nights of residency at age 15 again with the quintet.
Yeah.
And all different music, I think.
We always play new music each time we play. That's the kind of important to me to really keep the repertoire evolving. So at this point now we have hundreds of tunes we can play, which is great.
Yeah.
So we never play the same sets or anything. And what I wanted to do with that was also because that band sounds really good, and the first record we made was a really good studio recording. But I wanted to have a kind of live album, jazz live album, that could do some of the same as, you know, like Roxy and Elsewhere, or like, you know, some of those great live records where you really feel like you're in the crowd with the audience and like try to capture that. And I think that's, we really succeeded with that record. Maybe should we hear a track from it? Or
sure. That's Blues for Muse from Live at Age 15, the Creston Osgood Quintet. Creston Osgood is our guest here on the Late Set.
I'm still here. Yeah.
You are still here. And boy, there were a lot of really engaged people there.
Yes.
Which I remember. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was just this real sense of possibility and freedom, and anything could go, and sometimes did.
Yes. I remember I got into a freestyle about Slovenia and Slovakia.
Correct.
You were there.
Yes.
And that, I think I'm putting that on the record, actually.
I hope so.
Yeah. Two very different countries, but they sound almost the same.
Slovenia and Slovakia. They are
What's
not
the difference?
The same.
Nobody really knows.
Exactly.
We have kind of cultivated an audience with this band now. I mean, we have a reputation for being a great live act, and a lot of people come to see us play, and they are involved in our performances. And to me, that kind of brings it back also to how I imagine it used to be in jazz clubs in the 30s and 40s when, you know, people went out to see concerts to have a good time.
They were drinking and having conversations.
Yeah.
And, you know, people were trying to make out or whatever.
Exactly. Whatever that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
But yes, this is what I'm talking about, like to make the audience feel free also. And it's not that they're talking on top, like, because we are also doing sometimes pretty specific things. Like we will play an Anthony Braxton composition also, or like this, or do something where it really requires concentration from the audience. But they go there too. Like then they will all immediately shut up when they feel that that's what's needed. So I feel like we have a really good relationship with our audiences in this band.
This is something I want to talk about because the way I experienced the Copenhagen Jazz Festival when I went a couple of years ago, I remember there was sax bass drum trio happening at this cafe, and it started to get more and more out, and there were Danes who were biking and heard the music spilling out onto the sidewalks, and people would stop.
Mm.
And I just wonder, is there something culturally about curiosity, or what is it? Because I feel an openness for, yeah, okay, it could be avant-garde, it can be anything. I want to hear something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a Danish or Scandinavian thing. I think that's can happen anywhere in the world.
I just feel like that serendipity, I see it happening more when I was there.
Well, Copenhagen is also, the way it's laid out, is that you kind of, the way you experience the city as you move around, maybe invites more to stopping and allowing things to happen to you. Like it's almost, you can almost say that it's also an architectural thing. Like in some cities in America, for instance, you have to drive around, or like there's a little pocket here where something happens and then you have to go pretty far for another pocket to come. Same in Berlin for that matter. Where in Copenhagen, during the Copenhagen Jazz Festival, it's like the whole city becomes a jazz concert. They're somehow all connected, these performances. And I think, I mean, people pick up on that. I mean, I always believe that jazz music is very accessible and very easy for people to experience and enjoy. So I don't know why it started to become something you had to be educated to listen to. I never understood why that became a thing, or that it should be hard to listen to, or it's only for a select group of people who are, you know, have the right to engage with it. So, I mean, to me, it's music for the people. And summer in Copenhagen, everyone is sitting on the sidewalk drinking a beer or biking around and hanging out, and it's only natural that there's music everywhere.
What makes that music dangerous today?
Yeah. Well, the very, I think it's just dangerous to just be yourself today. I mean, people are curating. There's so much curation going on about how to behave. We're in like some kind of prison about, or at least the younger generations feel this like pressure to be in a certain way. And I think when they see a jazz musician lose him or herself in the process, that is controversial and dangerous.
Mm.
And just like during the Second World War, you know, watching somebody improvise on an instrument was in a way the opposite of the Nazis, you know, it's the opposite of what that stood for. I think you can say the same thing about jazz music today. You know, that everyone steps into character and lets loose their potential, this enormous power that all we humans have inside of us, limitless potential. I think jazz is can really open that up. And that is dangerous because if people start to realize how much power they have inside of them, you can't control them anymore.
I heard an interesting comment by, of all people, Harrison Ford, you know, Indiana Jones, Han Solo, etc. and so much more. Mm-hmm. But what I was struck by was what he said, and then I started to take it a couple of steps further. He was saying effectively that in this time, we have become effectively disaggregated and put into, here in America specifically, and put into sort of serviceable economic units. And I feel like that very same thing is happening in terms of turning Americans into serviceable political units. And now we have this very concerning union of the investor class, billionaires in this case, whose function is to make money in a capitalist society, with the levers of power politically. And the fact that we have been disaggregated and sort of spread into the wind in some ways has not allowed us to find our commonalities, which is really where the strength of humanity comes in. Sort of, I think about all this just in terms of people making music, being in an analog space, performing, having an audience, all of these different creative endeavors. I really feel like in some ways it could be an antidote, but it's the matter of kind of connecting these common points.
Oh, we are in the front line of that fight right now.
Yeah.
Musicians and artists.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt about that. I recently started a band called the Urias Ensemble, named after, you know, the Urias Post, you know, the first soldier who gets killed in the battle, you know, the one everyone shoots at first. And that's because I truly believe that just by example, just by showing people that we can stand up and make a personal statement in public and believe it ourselves and be beautiful doing that goes against all that. You know, this is my daily life. I meet people every day who see me doing that and they are inspired in their own life to make other choices. And that's the battle. I mean, that's why it's super, super important to have people being honest on stage, playing music and doing art right now. So yeah, for sure.
Why do you do it?
Well, for my own sake. No, I do it because I don't have a choice. I mean, yeah. I've never done anything else in my life. I never had any kind of job, not even washing dishes once or carrying a newspaper. I've never done anything but play, and I started doing it when I was 3 years old. And it's this like insane calling I have and drive I have. And if I don't do that, I'm nothing. I have nothing else. So I have to do it. But of course, when you do something so much and you become good at it over time and you get experience doing it, you also get more and more powerful doing it. And this is also why I spent most of my career seeking out the elders. So I used all my money, all my time looking up the people who were older and better than me and trying to see how they acted with the powers given to them. You know, people like Brother Yusef, Yusef Lateef, you know, Sam Rivers, Paul Bley, John Chikai. It's a whole bunch, a whole list of people that I actively sought out to see how it's going to be later and how to prepare myself for these later stages of this. And I think it's really important that we look at our elders and the people who invented this language, you know, and learn from them.
Do you think that generations behind you will say the same thing about you?
Oh, definitely. I'm already feeling it.
Yeah.
I'm feeling that a lot. And I'm not that old, I mean.
Right.
But I'm already like kind of being treated as an elder by some of the younger musicians. And I completely embrace it. And it's not an ego thing at all. It's I think it's a completely natural evolution of all the work we put into this. Like, I basically spend my whole life on this. I mean, all my time on this. So I think it's only natural that, you know, you arrive at a certain point and, you know, it's the path of these choices. So tomorrow I'm going to be playing with some of the heaviest older people I can think of, you know, Marshall Allen, Dave Burrell and Bobby Sankel, who are all, I all consider my elders. And I've been preparing for this concert mentally for months, you know, thinking about what will happen and how I'm going to react to whatever happens there. And
and then what do? Just release all that once you're on the stage and just listen?
No, it's not enough. It's not enough to just listen.
Yeah.
You have to also play. You have to assert yourself. Otherwise, you just sound like you are in for the ride and yeah. become pointless. So you have to play, and you also have to embrace wherever you are in your own development. And someone who's young is not necessarily more wrong than someone who's old. It's just different stages of the same thing. So I also have something to bring to that concert, which they couldn't bring. So that's how I see that. But I'm coming to it with huge respect and excitement about just being on stage with those people.
Kristen Osgood, thank you for joining us on The Late Set.
Thank you.
That's Josh Jackson and Kristen Osgood hanging in our studio, having a good time, and talking about some geopolitical realities that involve the music and our musicians and factor into this whole equation. It's an interesting time to be a musician playing a music that reaches across borders. And I guess I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. It's also interesting to be both Danish and American.
Right.
As Kristen is.
Well, I'm really glad that you had this conversation, that we made it happen. And I'm glad Kristen's out there doing the thing and connecting with, man, some real Philadelphia jazz royalty and sort of avant-garde eminence in this case. Really beautiful.
Kristen can hold his own with anyone. Even with me talking about jazz records, which I'm pretty impressed sometimes, that he knows just as much and sometimes more in some cases than I do, which is total nerddom.
Right, right. Speaking of digging, it's time for This I Dig.
All right, I'll give you, I don't know that I dig this necessarily, Nate, but it's something that I did.
I dug it a little bit. You dug in, that's for sure.
I certainly dug in to free breakfast on your birthday at Shady Maple. What in the world is Shady Maple? Everyone is asking. I was too, just a week ago. So it's in Amish country, just a little bit west of Philadelphia, out in Lancaster County. And there's this huge complex, including the Shady Maple Smorgasbord, which is, as you might imagine it, this huge place with hundreds upon hundreds of people all going to the buffet line. I went for breakfast because it was free, and I have to say it was worth it, not only because it was free, but the people watching, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I tried on overalls.
Now, crucially, I have to ask, did you try on the overalls before or after the smorgasbord? Because I could see that being a factor there.
Well, if you probably, I showed you a picture, so you could see it was a little tight in the midriff, so it was definitely after breakfast.
Well, see, you just got the order of operations wrong.
Yeah, I know. I should have just rolled in there looking like one of the locals.
All right. Well, there you have it. That is a culinary pilgrimage. My dig this week is a little more typically musical, but it also involves an outing. I went out and saw a show at the Met Philadelphia this month by an artist named Ray. And this is spelled R-A-Y-E. And if you are not hip to Ray, I first of all just recommend checking her out. She's got a lot of content online. You can find videos and all kinds of stuff. What I'm going to recommend is her new album, which is titled This Music May Contain Hope. And the tour that I saw, which supports this album, was the only word I can come up with is spectacular. It was just a feat of musicianship and stagecraft and energy and positivity. She's an incredible singer who can toggle between sort of classic Motown and neo-soul style hip-hop and British sort of show tunes and classic jazz. She just, you know, slips in and out of all these different modes. And her band was incredible, you know, just very, very polished, but also loose. There was, you know, not a small amount of jazz in her show. She's very clearly fond of jazz singing. But it's all folded into this, like, very sort of terrific production. The word that keeps coming up when people write about this album is maximalist. It really is true. There's a track on this album that says in the track list, featuring Hans Zimmer. And so you have to imagine anybody who has a feature with, you know, a symphonic composer, they're not thinking small.
Did you know the odds to be born on this earth's 1 in 400 trillion? I conquered those odds, yet I can't conquer leaving this house. I eat, sleep, scroll, and work, but there has to be more than just me existing. I was thinking there's not enough wine in the fridge to unleash me in this feeling. Fiends for some feminine healing. By that I mean I called my girls and said SOS, pick a dress, pick a time and an address, but we are going out tonight.
Highly recommend. If you listen and you discover her based on this recommendation, let me know what you think, because I'd love to hear what people make of Ray and her music.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Become one now at WRTI.org. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to leave us a rating on the platform of your choice. And subscribe and follow us all on social media at WRTI Music.
You can also reach out with some feedback. The email is editor@WRTI.org. That goes straight to me. The show is hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson, and produced by Alex Arif. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager, and he mixed this episode. Our production assistants are Alexander Bolliker, Jacob Dodd, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran.
We want to congratulate Delia and Alana specifically for graduating at Temple University. It's been great to have them on the team here at WRTI. They're now leaving us for big things, and we wish them all the best. We're going to miss you. Thanks for all of your help.
Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philly and beyond. We'll see you soon.
Bye,